So I got bamboozled into giving this talk. I thought I'd talk about sort of review of electromagnetic counterparts of binary black hole mergers. Lots of ideas by other people and a couple of ideas by me. And I'll emphasize the importance possibly of triple systems. I thought I would start off though with one thing, since I think it came up yesterday during Philip's talk, and it's something which I worried about for a long time, and after a while realized that at least under current conventional models is absolutely not an issue. So I thought I would bring it up since it was brought up yesterday. So that's the question of how massive stars form and what the pre-main sequence look like. So we heard yesterday about homogeneous evolution. You start two stars close to each other. If they're rotationally mixed, they don't expand into red giants. And that simplifies, in many ways, a lot of the evolutionary scenarios for making the black holes and allows you to get bigger ones. But then the question is, can you actually start two main sequence stars close together, given that, well, we all know that they were giant pre-main sequence stars, and so they must have been much farther apart early. And I'd just like to tell you that that is not the way massive stars are believed to form. Okay, so massive stars form observationally in the dense cores of clumpy molecular clouds. So molecular clouds are not Bonner-Ebert spheres of 10 to the 6 solar masses. They have shock waves and dense lumps in them of 1,000 solar masses, and it's in those little 1,000 solar mass clumps that the stars are formed. They're formed at very high density. Again, observationally, density is a sort of 0.1 to 10 grams per square centimeter column density. So these are really Compton-thick things. And the reason, basically, is that you need such high densities in order to get the accretion rate high enough that when the massive star starts producing 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 solar luminosities, it doesn't just blow everything out and prevent the accretion from getting above a couple of solar masses. So at those densities, the free-fall time of the parent clump is basically comparable to the formation time of the star. And as we'll see, the Kelvin-Helmholtz time is actually considerably shorter than this. So the star does not actually have a pre-main sequence large phase. It just grows from one solar mass up to 20, 30, 50, or 100 solar masses. So you can see, again, the accretion rates are sort of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 3 solar masses a year. So it's taking, of order less than 10 to the 5 years to actually grow up the star. Okay, so very early in the growth, of course, if the star starts growing, it's, say, initially it's a one solar mass star, then yes, it is indeed like a protostellar one solar mass star, which is many solar radii in size. But as we'll see, many solar radii in size is also the size of the final star. And so basically that's as big as they ever get, as big as the one or two solar mass star that's deuterium burning on the pre-main sequence. And then after that, as mass continues to accrete, they basically just join the main sequence, which typically happens around 20 solar masses. So the bottom line is that the maximum pre-main sequence radii are never very different than the main sequence radius of the massive star. So here is a graph from an old paper by Chris McKee and Jonathan Tan showing the pre-main sequence evolution of the 30 solar mass star accreting in one of these clumps. So it starts off at 0.1 solar masses, grows to 1, 10, and ends up at 30. So you can see that when it's one or two solar masses, it's basically, it's a pre-main sequence star, so it's about 7 solar radii, much bigger than the main sequence radius of a one solar mass star, and it's deuterium burning in its core. As it continues to grow, when it gets to about 5 or 6 solar masses, the core is still convective, but there's a radiative envelope that develops, and that radiative envelope basically prevents any further deuterium burning in the core. So you get deuterium shell burning, and in that case, you get the maximum radius of around 10 solar radii. But when the star gets to about 15 or 20 solar masses, the Kelvin timescale is so short it becomes less than the accretion time. So the star just begins to evolve up the main sequence. So it actually joins the main sequence while it's of order half its final mass in this case. And so you can see that the final radius is about 7 solar radii. The maximum radius it ever got to was about 12. Okay, so If you look then at more massive stars, so here are seven solar masses. So seven solar masses, when the accretion shuts off in this model, is still actually a 12 solar radius pre-main sequence star, and it then evolves down a Hayashi track and joins the main sequence. But if you look at the 30, 60, or 120, they go through this evolution, then the Kelvin time becomes shorter than the accretion time, and they just grow up to up the main sequence. So for the stars at 60 or 100 solar masses, their final radius is comparable to or larger than the maximum radius they ever got at any time during their growth. So for low mass stars, indeed, there is a big pre-main sequence and the stars shrink and you have to start them wider. You can't start them two solar radii apart for one solar mass stars, but you can certainly start a 60 solar mass star, 10 solar radii apart, because that's as big as it ever got during its whole pre-main sequence evolution. Okay, so I just thought maybe it was useful to clarify this.
But this still all assumes single star evolution, right? Because relatively need to form boundaries.
I'll come to that. It's just that the idea that of a Hayashi track. I mean, how we actually make the binary is different. But the point that there was a Hayashi track and sort of imagining that these stars started off at 100 solar radii is not the.
Have been out of fashion for a while.
They're out of fashion, but it was it's not. Takes a while for the out of fashion to get into everybody's brain.
So-called first line, right?
Okay. Now to the complications. Okay, so the complication is, these pictures were basically for spherical accretion of a single star. If the molecular core is not non-rotating but has significant angular momentum, then as the material comes in, it may not be able to directly join that very small star, but it may actually become rotationally supported and make a disk. And then once the disk is formed, then there's the question as well, I have a massive disk around a small star. Maybe the disk has a Toomey Q larger than one, and the disk mass gets to be comparable to the mass of the central growing primary after a while. And then the question is the disk actually able to accrete all the material onto the growing primary, or does the disk become so massive that it then fragments into other pieces? Usually we think of mass ratio and Toomey Q as the physical things to decide about fragmentation, but they're a bit hard to discuss. So in the paper I'll show you, it sort of re-expresses things in terms of external control parameters, this psi, which is basically the ratio of, up to factor of Q over alpha. It's basically the ratio of the accretion rate supply from the collapsing molecular cloud to the accretion rate that can be carried through the disk. And obviously, if the disk is very, so it's basically the ratio, the accretion rate from the outside is basically the core sound speed cube divided by G. And in the disk, you have a similar expression with an alpha. But typically, if the disk is thin, the disk sound speed is much less than that in the molecular cloud core. So this number is large, which means that you're supplying more mass than the disk is actually able to carry through, unless the disk gets sort of geometrically thick and is unable to cool. And the other parameter is basically the ratio of the disk's orbital time to the accretion growth rate time. And obviously, instabilities have a hard trouble if you're tripling the mass of the disk in less than one orbit. It's not equilibrium thin disk, and it's not likely to cool. Okay, so these particular simulations are from Kreter et al. Several years ago. There are tons of more recent ones, of course, but they sort of illustrate the point. So this is the parameter space. So here's the gamma, the ratio of the orbital time scale to the accretion time scale. And on this axis is that psi, so basically psi equals 1 as you're supplying mass at a rate that the disk can happily deal with, and as you get to larger and larger psi, the ratio of the accretion rate from the core is getting much larger than that in the disk. And so basically in that limit, as you might guess, you build up massive disks and they start to fragment, whereas on the other side you get just the single disk, which is actually able to accrete the material. And the one thing which might look a little strange, but is kind of an artifact of the resolution, is that they get multiple stars near the boundary and binary stars on this side, but they point out that that's kind of a numerical artifact because if they form the binary very early, that's when because they had an adaptive grid, that basically meant they had very poor resolution, so they couldn't resolve multiples at the time when the binary first formed. And you can see that in this case, you know, there's kind of a binary, but then the disks, each binary has its own little mini disk, and that's starting to fragment. But they counted this as a binary in that simulation. So. Okay, so this is the picture of how, at least one picture of how multiple and binary stars could form is basically by fragmentation of the of these disks. And of course, this is sort of following up to the formation of a sink in a couple of disks, and then as Andrew has described before, you know, what happens after that depends on torques in the disks and exactly what you do with the sink particles, which they put in the middle to be accreting. If there's a thin disk, typically the secondary, the lighter star, accretes more, which tends to drive the system towards equal mass. But if the disk is substantially thicker, then you can preserve high mass ratios. The question of whether the binaries that form are going outwards or going inwards, as Andrew described, is still something of a controversy. And again, the question of whether the circumbinary disk drives eccentricity also depends on the angular momentum torque. So I think we don't really know exactly what happens after this stage quite yet. We're making progress, and that's probably how a lot of binary stars form in these molecular cloud cores.
So a question, in terms of number three, in terms of preserving a high mass ratio, how high a mass ratio are you talking about? I mean, is it 10 to 1 or can it be like 2 to 1?
Well, I think again, it depends a bit on the disk, and I would say their simulations are actually thin disk simulations. This statement is sort of based on arguments that you build up an isolation mass so that you no longer draw, the secondary no longer accretes more because it's built a gap around it. I think in their case, they could get like 4 to 1. Or in this case, it was typically like 0.8. And here they could get 4 to 1. But I think we don't actually know whether 10 to 1 could happen.
I'm saying the vertical axis, because I mean, this whole argument by Gammy about, self-gravitating disks and, if you're 2 is less than 1, whether you get Vito turbulence or whether you fragment depends on the cooling time, I thought, of the disk relative to some orbital time. So is that equivalent? I mean, I understand here they're comparing accretion and orbital. I mean, anyways, I'm just... which regime one is in?
So in this picture, remember, these are kind of molecular disks, and in their picture at these scales are typically sort of thousands of AUs that these binaries are first forming, and so the cooling is really quite efficient. It's actually more problem. So the heating is mostly irradiation heating, but they're dusty disks, and so the question of how efficient the heating of the surface is of actually changing the mid-plane temperature, which is what you care about for heating the disk, I think is a question. So it's actually kind of the opposite, that the mid-plane actually tends to stay pretty cold even if you're heating the surface.
So basically, if you're unstable, you're going to fry.
Yeah, so
you're
basically.
You're not going to be able to be in this regime where you just have
heating from the surface. There's a whole literature on basically the one problem is that if you really took this seriously, you would never make a massive star because the disk would, you'd make a disk around a one solar mass star and then it would immediately fragment, and so you'd never get anything more than one solar mass. So Krumholtz's later papers are all about trying to stop the fragmentation to be able to make anything other than one solar mass stars. And Mike Grusinov and Phil Hopkins down the hall from me are also obsessing about this. And the popular story is that one solar mass stars produce outflows, and those outflows are going to vigorously heat everything around them, and therefore it's outflow heating rather than viscous heating in the disk, which is basically suppressing the fragmentation. You can also do it if you have sort of global magnetic fields from the molecular cloud core, which remain anchored in the disk, and those can also, the magnetic fields can also prevent the fragmentation. So the stories about how the disk temperature and heating is set are, I would say, a little fuzzy at the moment. So it's very easy to fragment, but in fact, the problem is to make massive stars, you really want to prevent the fragmentation. And so the story is that it's winds and jets from the protostars. But
What about the idea of just having stellar collisions? I mean, maybe you don't always have high enough densities, but isn't that a way to get at least quite massive stars in the centers of clusters?
So there are a lot of, we could get into this later. I think there are a lot of arguments. So for example, if you thought collisions were the dominant effect, you would expect to see the IMF to be different in higher density clusters. Mm-hmm. You also, at the densities of all observed clusters in molecular clouds, the density is about 1,000 times too low to have collisions be significant. So you have to invoke that there's actually some little subregion of the cluster which somehow originally was 10 to the 8 stars per cubic parsec rather than 10 to the 4, so that you can get collisions in a million years. And of course, there are papers proposing that, but I would say there's no observational evidence that that ever happened. And also the IMF seems to be consistent with basically not varying a lot from cluster to cluster, and you would have expected if it was really set by collisions in these high density regions that there would be some variation. So I guess my own feeling is that that seems a little less likely than the idea that it's actually somehow connected to the formation. Of course, you know, if you make a whole bunch of clumps like this, they could collide in some way and maybe refragment. So what the distinction between the growth and the formation is a bit fuzzy in these massive stars, I think.
So what I'm hearing is we don't really know how to make massive stars in this, and therefore any statements about binaries are probably...
Questions are connected.
So that's my point.
It's not the same question.
So basically, if we're not quite here on this, then the binary aspect is, if anything, more confusing.
Right. I mean, we know observationally statements about the outcome of all this, but you know, exactly what prevents the fragmentation at this stage is kind of being put in a little bit by hand at this point.
The issue is the viscosity gets, it cools off, the viscosity is too low, and then...
So at these stages, the cooling time is much less than the inflow time in the disk. So the disk is able to cool. And so if it was just the local viscous heating, there's also spiral arm heating and so on.
You said the separation was 1,000 EUs in this calculation?
Well, these calculations are actually scale-free, but if you sort of put in if you have typical rotation rates in molecular clouds, this starts off at 1,000. But of course, if you wanted to make a multiple in this stage, I made a binary which now has too many disks, so now I just go to this stage and the whole thing repeats. So the outer scale is 1,000, but this could happily produce 1 AU binaries in successive stages, I think. So another interesting thing I thought I would just point out in case people hadn't noticed it is this recent paper by Max Moe and Carlos Benenis, in which for a long time I've believed on the basis of globular clusters and halo stars that the binary fraction in low metallicity stars was much less than it was for solar metallicity stars. This paper says it's actually the opposite way, that the binary fraction is much higher at low metallicity than it is at high metallicity. And the reason is that those observational statements basically were statements about the observed binary fraction. If you correct for the selection effect that at low metallicity the lines are weak and it's hard to find binaries, that selection effect means that even though the binary fraction is low, the correction factor is so large that the binary fraction must in fact be higher. So that's basically the point of this. So here's solar metallicity. This is sort of metal poor giant spectroscopic binaries from the Apogee and other surveys. And it's around 10% solar metallicity, but goes up, again, corrected for selection effects, goes up to about 50% at the low metallicity. And then if you look at the period distributions, so here's solar mass, 0.1 solar, 10 to the minus 3 solar, and this is B stars. You see that as you go to lower and lower metallicity, the binary fraction at long periods, sort of hundreds of AU and above, doesn't change much. But the binary fraction at short periods goes up enormously and starts to approach that for B stars. So their interpretation is that the mechanism of the disk fragmentation mechanism is what's basically producing this peak. And it doesn't depend strongly on metallicity. And so low metallicity stars basically approach the same thing that massive stars are doing. It's very high multiplicity, and they in fact conclude that there's a large fraction, they actually have evidence that there's a large fraction of triples and so on here. So the usual lore that solar type stars have very few triples, it may be true at solar metallicity, but not at lower metallicity when they act actually much more like the O and the B stars. Okay, so question of the origin of close binaries. So we've discussed already the disk fragmentation and migration. You know, so by close binaries, I mean the ones that Philip would like to have started with yesterday, right? Of a couple of solar, a couple of stellar radii apart for homogeneous evolution. And so another is, you know, you could make a rapidly rotating bar and bifurcate it into two lumps. But the really popular one, I guess, sort of started off by Eggleton and Kisilova-Eggleton in 2006, and then Fabricchi and Tremaine and more recent versions, is to basically make them out of hierarchical triples. So you start with a, say, a 100-day binary with the triple outside at many tens of years. And if you wait a while, you can excite Kozai oscillations. If it's eccentric and you put in the quadrupole term, you can drive the inner binary to very high eccentricity where tides then capture it into a much closer circular orbit. And this basically shows in terms of the log of the ratio of the period of the outer binary to the inner binary. This is for solar type stars, so, but with multiplying all these by factors of 10, this approximately would work for the massive stars as well, although the tides are more uncertain. So this is what happens in 5 mega years. So this is basically when the Kozai time scale is just a few multiples of mega year. You can capture these binaries, but if you keep waiting for 5 giga years, then even wider and wider outer binaries can have Kozai time scales rather than 10 to the 5 years or a million years. They might have Kozai of 10 to the 8, but you just wait long enough and you'll scatter some binaries onto extremely eccentric orbits and capture them. So the close binary fraction actually evolves with time. For massive stars, you know, 3 mega years, even less than this, it's all over, right? They've turned into black holes. So this portion is relevant for solar type stars, but not for the massive stars. So just to remind you, so the Kozai time scale is the mass ratio times the period of the outer binary squared over the inner one. And this basically means it's the period at paracenter that matters, so the 1 minus e squared to the 3 halves. And so, for example, if you consider a 50 solar mass inner binary and 30 plus 20 or something in the inside, orbited by 2 solar masses, the inner one at 2 days and the outer one at 3 years, then the sort of Kozai time scale is about 30,000 years. If you start off something more like the initial conditions, where you might want, say, a 100-day binary, which you would like to make highly eccentric and then tidally capture into one of these 2-day binaries, then with an outer one of 100 years, same mass ratio, the Kozai timescale is about 600,000 years. And in the eccentric Kozai, to get really high eccentricity, you typically have to wait some random number, but like this many cycles till you get to the high eccentricity. In this case, it was 3 cycles till you got to high eccentricity. So you can see that for these systems, that's getting up to be of order the lifetime of the massive stars, right? So you could then perturb the black holes, but then they don't have tides, so you have to get it even more eccentric to do anything interesting. So doing it with the tides and the black holes, I think, is what Silvio was talking about during the conference. But if you wanted to capture them into close binaries, then this is sort of the limit. You want outer binaries of less than about a 100-year period in order to effectively capture things in the lifetime of the stars. Okay, so this shows the evolution, including the tide. If you get onto the eccentric orbit, and then you tidally circularize into a close binary.
So a question I've had about this, especially in the planetary context, so you're doing stars here, so it'd be easier to survive. If you want to get like a cold Jupiter, make it a hot Jupiter by this mechanism, then the process of circularization is going to involve a lot more energy than the binding energy of the planet. So is it obvious that the planet can, in fact, survive?
I mean, so in the planetary case, I think it's typically is, so you're right that the heating is an issue. In the planetary case, the tide is more the tide in the star than the tide in the planet that does the circularization. So in that case, there's not too much of a heating problem. In the stars, it's a bit more of a problem because the, but it does depend on how close this binary is. So I think if you're trying to make things with a separation of two stellar radii, then you know the tidal energy that you have to absorb is of order the binding energy of the stars within factors of two. So it is potentially a problem. If you circularize them at say three or four, then you know it's only a quarter of the binding energy, and so they puff up a little bit. But the remember though that if you, especially if you do it for these massive stars, the Kelvin timescale is only 1,000 years. And so you may heat it up, but very quickly you can radiate. And the heating, the, you know, depending on the model of the tide, the tidal time scale, in fact, can be comparable to the Kelvin time. So then you may not even swell up very much. But again, that there's a lot of uncertainty. And
you know, also for radiative stars, I think it's less of a problem because first you can radiate away a lot.
Yeah.
You have very little mass in the outer layers. Yeah. So if you project a little bit of that, it won't merge.
Thanks.
What is the tidal description normally assumed? These things like constant Q or?
No. So well, for the, again, there's a lot of things you could do. These models, basically for the highly eccentric case, they put in, they include dynamical tides. So they put in an oscillation, and I don't remember exactly the prescription they used for the time scale. I think it was basically modeled on the sort of wave steepening, wave breaking things from, originally by Jean, but then more recently by Fuller and others, but I don't remember exactly the details. But you know, I would say I wouldn't trust them to a factor of 10, but I don't think it makes a huge difference if you change it by that. Okay, so that was just the, you know, the introduction of how to make the close binaries. Now let me switch gears a bit to what I think is an interesting topic to think about, because the returns are so large and there's no data yet, so it's really fun for theorists. So electromagnetic counterparts to stellar mass binary black hole mergers. Okay, so in vacuum, non-charged black holes, merge them, no electromagnetism. Okay, so that's the baseline, but are they always in vacuum? So a lot of these were inspired by the claims in the first gravitational wave event. There was a 2.5 sigma gamma ray detection, which then immediately inspired a great many papers, including the first one of these. So this one said, well, if I have charged black holes with Q over M of 10 to the minus 4, so that's electromagnetic energy to mc squared of 10 to the minus 4 in the black hole, then the electric dipole and the spiral in could produce at 10 to the minus 4, sort of, you know, 10 to the 50 ergs a second, and a 10 to the 50 erg of energy. It would be in dipole electromagnetic radiation, but if we wave our hands nicely, then you say that's a GRB. Then if you have a somewhat lower one, well, you know, radio photons are cheap compared to gamma ray, so we could detect it at even 10 to the 42 ergs a second. So you can say, well, it's just like a pulsar, and well, of course, we'll get a fast radio burst. So I would say there are a couple of reasons why I'm a little not too excited about this one. So the first is if Q over M is larger than 10 to the minus 5, the electric field outside the black hole is so large that you spontaneously produce electron-positron pairs out of the vacuum. And so the traditional fundamental physics limit, even if there was no plasma anywhere else in the universe, is that Q over M is less than 10 to the minus 5. So I don't think this one really works. Now, the second problem is that, unfortunately, there are other things in the universe besides this. In particular, there are cosmic rays, and there's a gamma ray background. And so if you work out the rate, you know, how long you have to wait before a cosmic ray starts a pair, even if Q over M is less than that to start the spontaneous breakdown, it's typically like a second, and then you get Q over M of less than 10 to the minus 33. So anyway, this is, I thought I would mention it, but I'm not that's not the one I'm holding my breath for. Now, in the subsequent ones, I've put in red bonus points if the model was proposed before the first black hole merger we're seeing. Okay, so this simulation is from 2013. This shows a rapidly rotating core of a massive star, which makes a couple of lumps. The lumps fragment into two denser lumps, which are collapsed to black holes. This was the GR hydro simulation. Then the two lumps spiral together and merge while still accreting vigorously. So this was a case of basically you had a massive star with a very rapidly rotating core, which was able to fragment into two black holes, and the two black holes merged. And of course, after that, then, as you might guess, Avi Loeb wrote a paper saying, of course, this is where the gamma rays from GW150914 came from, and not only one paper, but even two papers. And so, and I think one with probably a lot of some contrivance of the synchronization, you could maybe do the same thing with common envelope, where you were spiraling a black hole into the other, but triggering the collapse of the second cores. Maybe it's a little trickier. You know, I would say the question of whether fragmentation actually produces equal mass objects is, I think, open to some question, and it's also rather unpopular at the moment to have massive stars with such rapidly rotating cores. We have a lot of evidence that there's a lot of angular momentum extraction, but again, I think this is, I would give more points to this one than to that one. Okay, so any enthusiasts of this one?
This also has been suggested for neutron stars.
Yeah, and the second paper, you could try to do this. There were earlier papers in the neutron star case. Yeah, yeah, the D'Orazio and Loeb also considered neutron star case. Yeah. Okay, the next one are zombie disks. Zombie disks is a technical term used in the planetary community. There are hundreds of papers on zombie disks. So a zombie disk is basically a disk which is so cold and doesn't have very much radioactive heating. There's not enough viscous heating to keep it actually ionized. So it becomes a neutral disk. There's no MRI. There's low turbulence. Alpha basically goes to zero. And so the accretion rate stops. And so in principle, you could imagine having a disk around either one black hole or both black holes in a circumbinary disk that might survive passively sitting there for giga years, unable to accrete because it's completely neutral material. Then when the two black holes merge, if we consider this first case, the two black holes merge, the mass, there's a gravitational binding energy radiated, which changes the mass by 5 to 20%, depending on the spins. that means that the material in this disk that was happily on circular orbits suddenly is no longer on circular orbits. So there are eccentric orbits. Those immediately produce a shock wave, which propagates out through the whole thing. That ionization then triggers the revitalization of the disk, the MRI, and the stuff begins to accrete just after the merger. And that's a circumbinary disk. You know, I give a few bonus points that this one was actually done before the event and advertised for electromagnetic signatures after it. And another approach is, which I think is a little harder to do, is that rather than having a circumbinary disk, you have a little mini disk around one of the black holes, and then as the other one spirals in, eventually the tides of the in-spiraling outer black hole produce perturbations in the inner disk, which again trigger the in-spiral. I think that one is a bit harder to get the inner disk to survive for this long, because you're already starting fairly close, and that one has also been proposed.
There's no heating, how does the disk avoid becoming gravitationally unstable?
So should
form. I guess one point here is you don't need very much mass. So I was being a little sarcastic. To get an interesting electromagnetic signature, the amount of mass that you need out here can be 10 to the minus 9 solar masses or something if you can dump it in fast enough. And so at that level, even if it's a, you know, sort of kept at the cosmic microwave background temperature, it's okay. But if you want more stuff, then it does become a problem. Okay, so this one, again, gets some bonus points for having been done actually before the gravitational wave, but this one I would say is really popular because it's fun and lots of calculations you can do. So binary black holes and AGN accretion disks. So this idea, there are various versions of how you get the stars in the disk, but one popular way, so I think you heard about it. I didn't, but many of you heard about it from Doug Lin, is that you have some nuclear star clusters. The clusters are brought in by dynamical friction. The stars in them, their motions get damped by the disk, and hopefully you can capture them in the disk. That part is a, seems, a, I think, one of the more difficult parts. And then once they're in the disk, then you can try to grow by accreting from the circumbinary disk in the AGN. If the surface density actually has peaks, typically at a few hundred gravitational radii, then they, you know, depending on your theory of migration, which also is perhaps an issue, you can move them to basically the peaks of the sigma where they get trapped and steadily accrete at one radius rather than just, you know, you clearly don't want the two binary, the binary around the supermassive black hole to just quickly go into the supermassive black hole. You want to hang it up, and so that's what the purpose of the migration traps is, to hide, try to hold them outside the central binary until they accrete enough material to become massive black holes, and then you want to merge them there. The question, of course, of whether this is a good place to merge, if the circumbinary disks are always steadily expanding the binary, that's not so good for merger, and that would be what Munoz and Lai says happens. But I think there's, as we heard again, there's a lot of controversy about that, so maybe you can move them together as well. I would say one important point about this story is that this model knows nothing about pair instability gaps. You can happily accrete. A lot of the early models were actually using this to make intermediate mass black holes. So I think there's no reason that 40 solar masses should be special. I think, you know, 80, 100, 200, 300, 500 should. And of course, the rate estimates vary from 10 to the minus 4 per cubic gigaparsec per year up to the thousands per cubic gigaparsec per year, but the thousands are less popular now because we have an observational limit. But so, you know, yeah, so the rates are uncertain. And the point about the electromagnetic counterpart is, well, I have binary black holes that are still vigorously accreting, and so I could do something. It might not be an exciting gamma ray burst, but there might be a change in the X-ray binary, and certainly I would have a little mini disk I could compress and make an X-ray, short X-ray flare and things.
Is it in fact clear that if you've got objects of, say, tens of solar masses that are the black holes, that within a few seconds of the merger they would be accreting actively enough to produce detectable signals? Also, they're in a disk, so I would imagine there'd be a certain, you're coming to that?
Well, so this certainly means that they're not merging in vacuum. The question of how, so there would be an electromagnetic counterpart. Now your question is, could I detect that as above the AGN? And the answer I would guess is probably no. But
the other one I want to make briefly is that there's two variations on this. One is this idea by Doug, and also the one that in my head, that you're trapping the black holes in the disk. But I also think you can just form black holes in the AGN disk through normal mechanisms, and then from in situ formation.
I think the normal mechanisms is a problem because there are theories of, you know, of the sort that I described above, where there's maximum column density at which you can form stars is 100 grams per square centimeter. In AGN disks, the density, even at a parsec or so, the tidal column densities are much larger than that. And so I think, you know, part of the reason for the popularity of these is we have no idea how you would actually make stars in an AGN disk at those densities. So
you would say the disks in the galactic center that form but over 10 million years were not an AGN disk. I mean, we do see massive stars that probably
form. We do see massive stars
in a disk.
I agree. So I think the two possibilities are all theories of current star formation of low mass and massive stars are wrong. One, And the second is that we, if they're correct, then I would say you can't make them in the disk, and so the observed stars must have been brought in from outside. I would give roughly equal weights to those two possibilities. But I'm not a star formation theorist, so. You know, if Phil Hopkins and his students were here, I would be shot. So, okay. A couple of other interesting possibilities before I get into the last one. So these are sort of making not electromagnetic counterparts associated with the merger, but things that might happen before or after. So Mikhaili and Peretz pointed out, again, this is sort of based on ideas for making planets around millisecond pulsars, that if you make the second black hole in a supernova with a kick, you can run the second black hole into a nearly radial orbit, where it will then be captured by the other one and merge in a short time. So the gravitational wave event would be preceded by a supernova. The probability of getting to a sufficiently radial orbit that you actually capture is rather low. It's just not running through a star. You have to get it close enough to the other black hole that it becomes bound through gravitational radiation. But their estimates were that, you know, 0.1% or something of sources, so 1 in 1,000 might happen at the position of a supernova, and that would be cool. Paper recently by D'Orazio and DiStefano is pointing out that if I have one of these circumbinary disks where the black holes are accreting and from many disks, then for the edge-on systems, you get lensing of one accretion disk by the other one, and so you would get a periodic lensing signal in addition to whatever accretion modulation of the sort that Andrew talked about, which might modulate the signal and be an interesting thing to look for. Okay.
Small.
Well, it depends how low the inclination is. Well, no. Well, it depends on the amplitude of the signal. I mean, even if you're at 80 degrees, you get a substantial, like a factor of two modulation. So it's not lensing to a caustic. It's just focus. It's just focusing enough. So the disk. Remember.
So you're magnifying the disk.
Magnifying the disk. Yeah. But again, it's the portion of the disk gets magnified anyway. You can in the paper they have various plots. But I agree. I would say the probabilities are not that much different than this. It's not 50% of sources, but it's 2%. Well, again, it depends on the inclination and what you assume about the
factors of a few or orders of magnitude.
So for the you can get factors of a few when you're pretty close within about a degree. So that's sort of the 0.01%. But you can get 10% modulation over much larger areas. So. Okay, so anyway, I think it's worth thinking a little bit more along these lines. I'm not sure either of these are such high probability yet. So let me know, start at the end, a little bit of something I've been thinking about. So this is basically making use of hierarchical triples. And the idea is that one way that you can do, again, not all the time, but a few percent of the time, is that if you make the massive black hole in a triple or higher order system, it's hierarchical. If the inner two stars make a black hole, the outer star eventually will evolve, fill its Roche lobe, or could be scattered in by Ledov-Kozai if it's in a quad, or passing stars and cluster perturbing its orbit. But in the simplest case, we just wait for a low-mass star to evolve, fills its Roche lobe, begins accreting. And then if it's still accreting at the time of the merger, then you have a circumbinary disk and accreting is going on. Of course, if it's finished its evolution long before the merger, that's not so interesting. So it's a way of making zombie disks. And if it finishes, if it hasn't filled its Roche lobe at the time of the merger, then it's pretty much uninteresting. So it's the timing problem. Okay, so just to review the picture version, we make a close binary. There's a third star orbiting outside. the inner binary evolves, maybe most simply by homogeneous evolution, so there's not a huge radius expansion in common envelope, but that can work as well. these two stars make black holes, leaving the third star out there orbiting. And of course, you have to worry that there might be some mass loss or kick velocity here. So that potentially limits the size of the outer orbit, but as we'll see, that's not a very big problem. And then the third star fills its Roche lobe and starts accreting with a detailed simulation of the accretion disk here. you make a nice circumbinary disk and mini disks. Two things merge, and once again, you have accretion. Again, the as we'll see, one advantage of this scenario is that, although I'm deeply disappointed by the 2.5 million kilometer arms, and I really wish we could go back to 5, but in principle, this source is a triple system, which you can identify many years before the merger, so that you know the time and to some precision the location of the merger. So you could actually be looking at this source with X-ray telescopes before the merger and then see if something changed afterwards. So I think that improves the chances rather than if you're just waiting for LIGO and you look afterwards, you don't really know what was there before. So I think, again, localization beforehand is something that
Why do you want to use 5 million kilometers for this?
So to get the sky localization. If I want to localize it.
Yeah, but you can still do it, better than square degree.
Yeah. So again, I think a square degree helps. It would be, I would say, these are could be quite faint X-ray sources. So having it to 10 arc minutes would be better, but that's all.
Yeah,
but, so one can certainly make a start with the existing one, I think, no question, but the longer base line would help. Okay, so just to sort of get an indication of the original sizes, sort of if we look at the, a few of the first LIGO black holes, the separations at and orbital periods of if the delay time was 13 gig years, so that's as large it could do, these initially start off with orbital periods of a few days. Obviously, they would be less if the delay time was 1 gig year. And just to give a sense of how big the binaries we're talking about. And then, again, this has been said many times, but if we then look at how many O stars have orbital periods of that range around here, something like 25% of them, so the O stars are the magenta, more than 16 solar masses. And so about 25% of them have orbital periods of 2 to 20 days. And a lot of these longer period systems are not, or in fact, most of these longer period systems are not binary stars with those periods. These are the outer companions of these guys, so the typical O stars in a triple or a quad. So these longer period systems are actually orbiting a lot of those guys. Okay. Oh, and another point is that for the O stars, there's a preference that these two inner stars actually be sort of comparable masses, are not drawn randomly from the IMF. Whereas if you get out to the wider triple systems, they're drawn more randomly from the IMF, so they're more dominated by the lower mass stars, typically. There's some massive ones out here, but the O stars often have A star companions with large radii, for example, or B stars. Okay. I just put up here a couple of these systems. I have a longer list if people want to look through. So I think this one, Philip mentioned yesterday, so this one in the SMC, I think Philip mentioned these two stars, but didn't mention that the system is actually a quad.
Can you
send
the light?
And there is a, there.
Right.
Okay, so this system consists of a 66 and a 61 solar mass star with an orbital period of 19 days, and those who love circularization timescale should be aware this one has an eccentricity of 0.2 to minus 0.01, so it hasn't circularized this way. But this star also in the same spectra, so this separation in period is unknown. It's less than a tenth of an arc second, but we know what this is. There's a 20 and a 10 solar mass star with an eccentricity of 0.82 in a period of 96 days. So it's at least a pair of binaries which are orbiting, but whether this period is 10 years or 1,000 years, we don't know.
We don't even know whether they're connected.
We don't actually even know if they're a common problem.
So I mean, you were saying on the 5-to-1 resonance, looks like
it's only... Yeah, so one argument is that it's actually a 5-to, I mean, it's it's 5:1. So they're in the same pixel, they're unresolved on the sky.
That's how much?
That's a tenth of an arc. So a tenth of an arc second would be about 1,000 AU. So it could be a chance alignment, but it's consistent with there being gravitationally bound if the separation is, you know, the radial separation is comparable to the theta. So another one, which is much more secure because this one, the orbit has actually been followed by adaptive optics, is Sigma Ori, which is the O star, which is responsible for ionizing the Orion system. Okay, so it's a famous nearby O star. So this one consists of a 19 and 15 solar mass, quite eccentric binary with a period of 143 days. And then there's a 9 solar mass star going around it in 157 years, so typical triple system. So just thought, you know, the famous one and the nearest one are representative, but I have dozens more if you want to see. There are systems with 6 stars and all kinds of patterns and stuff, so anyway. Okay, so I think we said most of that. So the question of the survival, so I'll discuss the kicks in a minute. obviously, you don't want the black hole progenitor star in the simplest case to have a huge radius expansion. but as we'll see, I have a graph that even if you allow some expansion and you don't believe in the homogeneous evolution, some interesting triples can actually survive in that case.
Quick question, when you assume no mass loss, does that include even like the collapsed two black hole where you convert, like you lose about 10% to?
No, that's fine. That just makes an eccentricity of 0.2 or something.
Okay, but it also does give you a plow kick between the inner and outer binaries.
Well, that's right. So as I say, this is the simplest case. I will now show you what's allowed. And in fact, 50% mass loss and 100 kilometer a second kicks are fine for a lot of systems. So, but I would say, you know, it's a question of whether you want every triple to survive or just 50% of them. But for what we know about the rates, I don't think it matters much. if we consider the kicks and the center of mass change from the mass loss, basically, the outer binary sees a center of mass kick, which is about half the kick velocity if I have a pair of equal mass binaries. So for a kick velocity of 100 kilometers a second, that means I get 50% survival at less than 5,000 solar radii, so that's about 10 AU. So I can have a triple star up to 10 AU that survives, or a bit less for the lower mass black holes. So the really wide binaries, the ones, you know, with orbital periods of 10,000 years and 1,000 AU, the kicks probably disrupt. But ones which are actually more interesting from the point of view of mass transfer, where you want the rush load to be less than, say, 1,000 solar radii, so that you can fill the rush load, that's separations of less than 20 or 30 AU, those are the ones which actually it's not too much of a problem of surviving, basically because the black holes have so much mass that the outer kick is rather small. Okay, let's see, I don't want to say anything about this. the next question is the later accretion. So the accretion timescales, of course, basically depend on the red giant lifetime. So if you consider, you know, outer stars of a couple of solar masses, it was the example I gave in the COSI timescales, the red giant lifetime during which you might be accreting is around 10 to the 7 years. And that's to be compared with typical delay times for merger of a gigayear. So this is about 1% of the lifetime. And the lifetime of a two solar mass star is of order a gigayear. So it's really a question, you have a delay time of order gigayears, you have a lifetime of order gigayears. Obviously, if I have shorter ones, it would be more massive stars, longer ones, lower mass stars. And the coincidence in the timing of the gigayear, you have to get right to about 10 to the 7 years. So it suggests that about 1% this accretion would actually be happening during the merger. And again, have tons of models and stuff that give more complicated versions of that. But I don't think the answers are not actually more reliable than that 1% estimate, although the work involved was considerably more. So. And, yes, my advisor, Martin Rees, used to talk about Puritan Americans or something, wanting to do a lot of work to get an answer that you could get just as well on the back of the envelope. Okay, so you know, what would this actually look like? So the system beforehand is basically a circumbinary disk accreting onto two black holes, and so it probably looks something like bright X-ray binary or ULX. And I would argue that in many cases we do not actually know whether some objects that we call bright X-ray binaries ULXs are not actually like this. We really don't know that. I mean, the inner accretion disks have all kinds of 1 over F noise, and the question is, could on that we detect some binary modulation? Not totally obvious. And so we might already know about some of these, but we don't know that. So if there are many, so I think the possibility of getting some event actually associated with the merger depends a lot on the mini disks. So remember, the circumbinary disk in the simulations that Andrew showed, the accretion of streams make smaller disks around each of the black holes. And during the final stages, when you're driven by gravitational wave mergers, those mini disks can be basically squeezed and forced in by the spiral arms driven by the second black hole orbiting them. So you might enhance the enhance the accretion rate. So you know, it becomes a brighter X-ray source for a short time, but it's a pretty short time. So I think we wouldn't know that unless Lisa had told us when and where to look in advance. The possibility of in the merger, of course, the enhanced accretion rate might produce an sort of bursting outflow that you might detect in the radio at later times. So, you know, I would say none of these are obviously producing some spectacular gamma ray burst that we would know about, but it does mean that I think, you know, the sum of all of these models that I've told you about suggests that a lot of the, you know, some significant fraction of the merging black holes will probably not be accreting in vacuum, but they will probably be X-ray binaries before, they will be X-ray binaries after. There will be a big difference, and there might be an extra burst lasting, you know, a day or hours before and during the merger that we could look at if Lisa told us when and where to do it. But I think it's probably not so promising all sky, just because, again, it's not obviously a gamma ray source. Okay, so this was just to point out to Lisa, one can actually, for these triples, because if they're close enough to be undergoing mass transfer, the outer orbits are, you know, a few AU, orbital periods up to maybe 100 years, so you certainly see the acceleration and potentially even a significant part of the orbit if they're, you know, it's a 3-year orbit and it's at least a lifetime is 3 years. You might actually see some of the orbit in the in spiral, but more typically the orbital periods would be longer, and you could identify these at least from the accelerations fairly straightforwardly with Lisa. Again, lots of papers about that. Okay, so the last thing to mention is, so suppose the homogeneous evolution is not true, so there's a local author who can explain the details, but if you consider the COSI with the triple systems, again, if I have a fairly wide outer binary, and I start off not with an extremely wide inner system, so that rather than requiring that the inner COSI get driven to a very high eccentricity, but I start off with, say, 100 days and 10 to the 4 days for the outer binary, I can have common envelope evolution create the inner binary black hole at lower masses. So this, I think, doesn't work if you're trying to make 30 plus 30, but if you're making 15 plus 15, you can make the inner binary with the common envelope and still afford to have an outer binary which is not disrupted by the common envelope and the tides and is close enough to actually have mass transfer during that stage. So for the lower mass black holes, I think this, and low metallicity, I think this could work even without the homogeneous evolution, but for the 30 solar mass black holes, I think it probably really requires the homogeneous evolution for the inner one to allow the outer binary and the triple to be close enough to undergo mass transfer. Okay, so.
So you mentioned that, you know, we can't rule out that ULXs could be these binaries, but I mean, can we say something of, if it were true that this were the only channel of black hole mergers, you know, how many of the ULXs we know would be this? I mean, I don't know how many ULXs we know of, but is it likely that any of them would be these systems?
I think
optimistic assumption.
Yeah, so you know, the number of ULXs we know depends on your definition of U. But under conventional definitions, you know, of requiring it to be at least 10 times neutron star Eddington or something, I think there's probably a couple dozen ULXs known. Of those, you know, maybe a third are really well studied. And you know, the prediction here is that of, you know, again, it depends. So if you just sort of imagine the population synthesis of the binaries and of the massive stars and ask what fraction have triples in the right range, again, it's of order of percent that would be accreting at some stage. So it could be, you know, of order 10% of the ULXs, I think could easily be, but 10 is the usual astrophysical, so I would allow 1 to 100.
Yeah, because I'm just envisioning a scenario where you like some kind of, with some future X-ray instrument, some kind of local, you know, census of all the ULXs, and then, you know. But this is a different question of whether you could collect enough that you could tell, okay, one of those.
Well, I think
one of them was the.
But I think the issue is probably, you know, it's not just a matter of collecting them. I mean, I think, you know, it's an interesting question. Do we actually know of even, you know, the famous X with a small number of systems in the Milky Way, do we actually know that those are not, even though those have been incredibly well studied, let alone the ones in more distant galaxies? And I think there is, again, this is a question that the accreting black holes have this enormous 1 over F noise, and so if you're looking for a, you know, a 15% modulation of the accretion with, you know, some fuzzy periods, I don't know whether we would actually.
Most of them don't have periods, right?
That's right. Most of them. I mean, there's so.
I guess
very few.
Well, I guess I'm just saying you're focusing on, you know, having LISA to localize it so you could tell what does it look like before. I guess I'm just imagining is it going to be possible to get a large enough sample that you wouldn't need to do that. You would just say, okay, well, you know, I know how many X-ray sources were that part of the sky.
Well, but remember the lifetimes. So they could spend 10 to the 7 years in this phase, right? So if you're asking, can we find 10 to the 7 of them so that when one per year happens, we actually already have the list of 10 to the 7?
Probably.
I don't know, I'll ask the X-ray astronomers, but they're shaking their heads.
That's my guess.
Yeah, so I think pre-identifying them just in a blind all-sky survey, I think, is not the way to go. You want LISA to tell you where to look. Yeah.
You described a lot of ways potentially of getting EM counterparts to stellar mass black hole mergers, ranging from the ruled out to the improbable. And what I guess I'm wondering is.
Well, improbable, I would say, so, you know, I think, you know, this story, I think, it's hard for me to imagine that it does not happen, right? I think it must happen.
That's what I mean by
the question is, whether.
So the
question is, if you have one black hole merger, when you have 100 of them, it would be surprising to me if one of them wasn't in this stage.
Fair enough. What signatures would each of these mechanisms have? Are there ways you could distinguish between them? So suppose at some point there is a clear EM counterpart of some sort, not the kind of questionable level that we had before. Are there things you would look for specifically to say, yes, it's got to be one of the following?
Well, so I think this one, I think the hope is that, you know, if we got to the stage where we had 100 mergers within, you know, several hundred megaparsecs, so maybe that's a decade worth of collection of these, and you localized them, these would not be in galactic nuclei typically, whereas the AGN disks really should be in sufficiently bright AGN, the nuclei of sufficiently bright AGN. That means to, also means to me that that makes it very hard to find them because you have the X, there's a bright, there's an X-ray source that's way, potentially way brighter than this, which is also varying a lot, and you have to find it underneath that. Whereas here, this might be a quiescent galaxy, and this might be the brightest X-ray source 30 arc seconds away from the nucleus. So I think it's probably, you know, it's hard, but maybe easier to actually identify these. If you see a gravitational wave merger, which is localized to the center of 3C273, then, you know, I would tend to vote for the AGN one, but I think it will be hard to get a real observational signature other than the localization from LISA, not.
Yeah, well, it's hard to localize it anyway to that precision without the counterpart, right? Yeah. It's always fragile.
Well, that's why I picked 3C273. You know, if it was within a half degree of 3C273, yeah. Well, there would be papers written.
I think you statistically would say after a certain point of time, okay, yeah, maybe there were, you know, there are an unusual number of AGN in these boxes. I mean, at some point you could say this with enough events, but that's different.
So I think if the high end of the AGN rates are, you know, 100% of them are this. And so if, you know, half or every black hole is associated with an AGN or at the appropriate distance, I mean, you have a distance cut, not just the direction, that would be an indication. But I think actually confirming the electromagnetic one will be difficult in the AGN case. Yeah.
So when you have the accretion from the external star to the binary, the orbital inclination of the inner binary is different from the outer binary. So the disk, the knife form, is misaligned relative to the orbital plane.
Maybe, but not in the cases that we're interested in, because if you have it highly aligned, then the cosi is much more dramatic, and so you have to push the binaries farther out. So the cases we considered were ones where it was sufficiently, I mean, to get it, you know, it could be 10 degrees off, but it's not like a 90 degree misalignment or something. So that, again, there could be the highly misaligned ones, but I think they're probably rarer because you need wider binaries than for the aligned case. And there's some indication, although in these stars, you know, we really have very little indication, but for lower mass stars, that the outer binaries actually do prefer to be aligned, which suggests maybe they form from the accretion, you know, a single accretion disk. But
so in principle, one thing you can do maybe with LISA is the detecting the modulation, right, of the waveform. So that doesn't rely on the fact that you have to have the accretion concomitant with the merger. But
yeah, no. So LISA would tell us about ones which we'd find out a big sample, including
exactly
ones which there wasn't. Yeah. So I think if we found a lot of triples, that would be a.
So that would give an idea of what are the channels that for these things. Anyway, if we had the problem with LISA to do the trick of, you know, maybe pointing that and see the modulation, so you know it's a triple, so maybe you want some extra care to see if there is a flare and a merger, is that the high frequency sensitivity. It's not really a problem of how long the armament is. It's really that the high frequency sensitivity is not really good enough to get many of these binaries that go through the LIGO band. So you might expect a few per year, maybe. So, you know, if you're talking about 1% of systems in this channel, probably these are low. In terms of the localization, the one that crossed through the band, They can have, let's see, better than a square degree, maybe 0.1 square degree. So that's in the field of view of, for example, Athena is there. So, you know, you have like a powerful X-ray telescope, which has the roughly the.
Yeah, no, I think that's what that was a promising. At least you can get the data whether there are enough messy X-ray sources that you could say which one it is without the better position,
yeah,
I think is the issue. But at least you would be able to point big telescopes in the right place.
These are indeed X-ray sources because vision is in X-rays.
I agree. X-rays are clearly.
The radio comes apart.
Did Pitts paper look at combining ground-based and LISA for localization or just the mass estimates?
Sorry?
Kurt Cutler had that paper where he combined the observation of LISA with the observation of LIGO for mass estimates, but did you look at combining the two localizations as well?
So who combined the...
So you're saying you see a...
So if you can phase, I guess the question is, you can actually phase them.
You get a response with LISA, and then you get the light, that you get the Cosmic Explorer observation, and then you can say...
So that's if you can phase them up, I think, basically, to get a really accurate position. Yeah, I guess the one case I would worry a little bit is with the accretion. I guess it would be worth checking whether that would screw up the phasing, even if you could do it, but... Because you're accreting at least 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 6 solar masses over the years in between, and that's... but it's definitely worth thinking about. And of course, you know, if there were you know, one of the many proposals for something at the intermediate frequency of this IGO, BBO, and relatives, that would be really great, because then we'd get a lot more. And
That would be a clear case for
point one
Earth.
And if the phasing is screwed up, it tells you that there is far away, so they jump anyway, which is interesting.
Okay, other points, other questions?